Hey everybody, welcome back to No Killing Goblins. I'm Oshi and I'm with
Dragonus?
Oh god. Even with like three chances, Dragonus still can't. You know what? Let's move on.
It was a long enough pause, I got confused. Listen, okay, I'm history's greatest monster, everyone, also known as Dragonus 45. Welcome back to No Killing Goblins Season 3.
It is? Oh my god, it technically it is Season 3, right? We did finish Volume 2, yay! And now we are trying a whole different setup for Volume 3, which will be a lot less granular and chapter specific, and instead we're going to talk about themes and characters and try not to delve too deep into the nitty-gritty because there's just too much.
Yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong, we will still absolutely be delving into the nitty-gritty, whether we say we will or whether we say we won't. But I think what this is going to give us a better chance to do is try and encapsulate the various arcs that stretch over the volumes and talk about them more in isolation, if only because as the volumes get longer and longer, it would be real awkward, say, to talk about our subject of today, Laken, for his first two chapters, and then months later talk about his second two. Whereas if we package them all at once as their own sort of self-contained overarching story, we can talk about all his themes and all of everything he's got going on.
Yeah, it's part of that, but this is also part of something of an opinion that I've developed over the years following Pirate ABBA. I think somewhere along the way, roughly I think the middle of Volume 2, Pirate really got into the web serial nature of things, the serialized fiction nature of things. I'm not even going to say web serial, just the serialized nature of it. And they genuinely began to play with the form itself, and I feel like TWI is less a singular novel series than it is a series of novels told in conjunction with each other. So instead of Pirate doing the traditional publishing thing where they write one series and then they write another series on the side that also gets published and another series on the side, Pirate just decided, I'm going to do it all in my own time, in my own way, and there's going to be a bunch of different storylines, and some of them will intersect, and some of them won't, and they'll be set in the same thing, and it'll be really fun. And they went whole hog into it, and that's what I think of it. And I really was thinking about this because the Kindle books, the way they're organized as if they're novels, really doesn't work in my head. Because, honestly, it's more like a collection of novels and stories than it is each volume, I mean, rather than being individual novel all the way through, right?
I think that for the like way that they have been broken down, because each of the volumes is, yeah, feels like it's multiple books, and the way that the Kindle books have broken down does feel pretty natural to me, although that might just be Andrea's great narration, like smoothing over any narrative flaws. But I think you're right and wrong. I think that the Kindle books work out better in practice than you're giving them credit for, but I also agree that The Wandering Inn is absolutely somewhere between 4 to 5 different coherent novel series, all sharing screen time with one another, where you have this ability to leisurely move from plot point to plot point. You can stop at a little cul-de-sac, explore a character a bit more, and kind of fine-tune things back and forth like that when you have that free word space that you don't always have to murder your children like other artists do.
Yeah, and Pirate does form a good narrative through line throughout each volume, and they do have a strong theme going from beginning, middle to end. It meanders, it goes through lots of supporting things, and it can explore a lot of other aspects of those themes, but there is a connective tissue between all of the stories being told within a volume, right?
Yeah. And I think that's probably like one of the strongest things Pirate does manage to do is manage to keep everything tied together.
Yeah. Speaking of commentary on this, we had someone, what's the word when somebody adds you? Somebody adds you on Twitter. Whatever. We got a message on Twitter from someone who said that they think that Pirate's biggest flaw is scale creep, not power creep, but too many POVs. And this is my response to it, is that it is a collection of stories. It's not a just inherently one novel through line all throughout. And if you treat it like that, it's easier to see the whole of it, because then you can like pick your particular through line story and just read that and come back and read the side stories or the whatever would be a side story to you. For example, some people might think of Flos as the main character and just want to read all the Flos chapters, and that's cool. I mean, if they want to do that.
I'm impressed that those words left your mouth and that you didn't, like, wither on the spot and die saying them.
God damn it. I was trying to be magnanimous.
I know who you are, but I'm just saying, I don't personally think there's anybody who thinks of Floss as the main character. If I had to pick somebody over there, it would probably be Trey, who I think we'll be getting to see more of this volume.
Yeah, we might, but in any case, what happens with all of this, we get a lot of like pushback about why is this POV not coming back, why is this POV not happening. It's because people enjoy those particular characters and think of them as the most important one or the one that they want to read about the most or explore the most.
What they connected with.
Yeah, and at first I got annoyed by it, but I thought about it in terms of what it's like when someone writes a main series. Like, David Weber wrote the whole Honor Harrington thing and then wrote, like, 19 different, like, side books to it. And would not go back to the main series for the longest time, and everybody was bitching and stuff. It's the exact same thing. And I've been like, yeah. I mean, it's just a natural outgrowth.
Well, it's the natural outgrowth, and it's one more reason why he was wrong not to kill her off. Another author talked him out of it, and that's a whole other discussion. Which is also, I think, a downside of the serial format. And if there's one thing that over the course of TWI I'm afraid of, it is the concern that every character who gets any degree of, like, narrative presence or point of view needs to be continuously followed up on. That's my one worry. And so far, that hasn't been a big concern, but going into later stuff, which we'll talk about, God, it's volume, like, 8 stuff, so we'll get there when we get there. But I think that that's something Pirate mostly has managed to efficiently dodge.
Yeah. Okay. We dive right into this particular topic of how we're going to handle this, but I suppose let's take a moment and be like, how are things?
Oh, things have been awful on my end.
I'm bored and it's rainy. That's my life. So let's talk about your awful existence.
Honestly, it was just some medical stuff. It's not even anything juicy or like cool as a medical problem, just, you know, you get old sometimes, and apparently that just means life sucks.
Dragonus does not have cancer. Disclaimer, Dragonus does not have cancer.
No. Well, technically speaking, it is a hypothetical cancer scare, but everything that you get sick with, I guess, is hypothetically a cancer scare. So,
at least you got a doctor to look at you. I don't think I could even get that. I think if I had cancer, I'd probably be dead.
If you get me really complaining about my boss and my current insurance situation, we'll be here all week, and then I'll have to delete the episode. actually, that's the other fun thing that I've got going on. As of today, I have just started up. I'm on a career change. I'm going to look into being a paralegal.
Woo! That is all. Yeah, for me, it's mostly been trying to keep up with all the different pieces of work. It's been a little bit of a struggle time management wise, and I'm getting frustrated. I've genuinely been thinking about like just quitting my day job and living on bread and water for a little while just to get back my equilibrium. I don't know. It is where I am. Lots of people have been changing things post pandemic, and I guess I'm in the same space mentally. I don't know if I can be in financially and stuff like that, but it's there. Just thinking about what I want to do and whether or not it's worth it. I don't have kids. I don't think I will have kids ever. I don't have a permanent partner, and I don't know if that's going to change in the near term or even in the midterm. And I do have an elderly mother. Well, she's not elderly, but elderly mom to take care of. And outside of that, I don't really have people or things that I'm responsible for. And my mom's still ambulatory. She lives a full life, so it's not like I'm the only way she can exist. So it's just making me think about my options. I guess that's what fall and winter does to you. Okay, just on a recent thing, though, there was a meetup of folks from TWI in Israel. It's Nobody, the mod in the Discord, and Acrasia, the, I think, former mod for the Reddit. They organized something, and like five people, very all guys, but they all went out and met together and had ice cream, I don't know, somewhere in Israel.
And also some ramen, I think they said, which is cool and exciting, and is one more reason, like, this is why I always post about how I'm going to be at a convention whenever I can go to one. But the last few that I've been to haven't been, like, big conventions that are going to pull a wide swath of people already coming in. But coming up next year, I'm going to step up my convention game and start going back to some of the big ones that I skipped this year. And I'm going to be adding everybody with the fury of somebody about to get banned, trying to see if I can't track some people down to come meet me at Gen Con or something.
I will say, okay, not to be weird about it, but these are Israelis who are just, like, most of them are post-military. Like, if you don't know, Israel has a compulsory military service. And they look good, man. They look really good in the pictures. It was cool. Okay. And they had ice cream. Honestly, I don't know who the person, and I was disappointed that not everybody was wearing merch. Very. But at least one person, I think, was wearing something. And they had, like, elephant trunk ice cream in the picture. I wanted that ice cream so badly. I don't know.
I mean, that picture just made me want ice cream more badly. But by the time that I saw it, it was too late for me to go get ice cream because we had to record.
It just lit a fire under me. Because I know there's a whole buttload of fans in and around New York. And, I mean, it's New York City. It's relatively easy to do meetups, but it's like the middle of October and it's cold and I don't want to leave my house. But I reached out and I think we might be doing something this month.
Heck yeah. I am kind of off in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee, and the lack of people that I've been able to find going to Georgia conventions makes me think that I might be in a bit of a dead spot as far as TWI goes.
I know for a fact that there were some people talking about going to Dragon Con.
Well, yeah, but that's what I'm talking about, like, those big conventions where you get people from everywhere coming in. There's a difference in scale and how far people will travel to go to a convention. And Dragon Con's one of those ones. There's a joke around here, especially up more towards Nashville, where there's a bigger IT-like business community, that basically the entire IT industry in Tennessee shuts down for Dragon Con. And it does in most countries. Everybody comes to DragonCon.
Yeah.
Not so many people come to, you know, MomoCon, which was the last one that I went to.
Speaking of DragonCon, I never talked about this before, but I was so disappointed that we didn't get to put Pirate on the, what is it, on a nomination list at DragonCon. It's such a popular, it's a completely a popularity contest. If you get enough votes, you get on the ballot. And clearly, I mean, it's Dragon Con. They probably had, like, hundreds of thousands of votes on specific writers and things. But, you know, some tiny part of me had wished we could have gotten Pirate on, like, some kind of specialized ballot or something. They withdrew from the Stabbies, so I don't know. Where else can we get them a prize?
Oh, I had missed the Pirate withdrew from the Stabbies.
Yeah, they haven't been part of the Stabbies for a while just because, I don't know if they withdrew or they were like, okay, you won too many, let's chill.
Like, I'm Pirate Abba, I am the greatest, I will gracefully withdraw so other people
can. Okay, so that's been my time, I guess. We're supposed to talk about books. We've been trying to do that recently, haven't we?
I mean, I have read some good stuff recently. I have been on and off on a few other different web serials, but we've talked a lot about Beware of Chicken as is. I just read most of volume 3 in one go while I was feeling sick.
Oh, wait, did you were curious about a title, like you were DMing me about it. Did you get a chance to read that?
Well, no, I was actually looking for recommendations for a friend who had to take a bus ride a long, long way with a 12-hour holdover. And it was the kind of thing I thought he might be interested in. I looked it up and I'm also interested, but it's on a list, a long list.
Oh, anything that goes on a list never gets read. If you read it, you read it.
But I did have something that I'd wanted to talk about, which was the book that just came out. It's the third book in a series, and I wanted to talk about the first one a bit, Gideon the Ninth. Which, oh, is that a good a bad a neutral
An overexposed
overexposed?
Too many people talking about Gideon to me. Just way too many people talking about Gideon.
Okay, I realize too many people might be talking about Gideon to you, but honestly, I do not actually see that many people talking about the Locked Tomb stuff.
I'm sure you're welcome to talk about it. I'm just saying, like, this is like overexposure for me. At this point, I refuse to read it just because too many people have hyped it up.
I mean, that is your decision, and every time I hear somebody say the, well, everybody recommends this and says it's good, and I'm tired of hearing about it, so now I'm never going to read it. I just think, like,
I'm spiteful. Give me a break. I'm spiteful.
yeah, but you're breaking your own, like, toy because somebody gave it to you and said it would be fun to play with. It is not a for everyone series, though, and I'm just going to preface this up front.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to say a lot of great things about this book series, and then I'm going to finish it off with probably the biggest deal breaker I can imagine. To say all the good things about it is tightly plotted, it has an amazing descriptive atmosphere, there's a real sense of history to everything that goes on. Tamsin Muir, the author, she is spectacular.
She's an actual poet. Like, she's won awards for her
Yeah.
poetry. She's very, very good.
And her ability to weave this narrative just on the prose level is some of the best writing I've ever read. And to add on top of that, you have the first one, which is kind of like a murder mystery at even shittier, less safe Necromancer Hogwarts. And it's definitely the kind of series that a person is going to have to read more than once. These books have so much going on, and they're very dense in, like, you don't notice it at first, but you go to reread it and you see the things you missed and how good the foreshadowing is. And I don't know, they make me feel stupid in a good way. If anybody gets what I mean, they get what I mean. The characters themselves are all really good. There's a lot of great character development, there's a lot of great character work, and like really fun, interesting characters you meet. Each book actively changes the narration style in a really experimental way. Like the first one's kind of a straightforward thing, the second one gets told in third person. I can't even begin to describe the third one. All of these are great things, but here's the deal breaker. As great as the character growth and characters and character work is, the two main central characters, particularly Harrow, but also kind of Gideon, are massive fucking assholes. It's like reading a book of two Ryokas. It is double the Ryoka. Cal Ruth just subscribed to this chat.
Jesus Christ.
But like, Gideon is a smarmy, snarky, fairly violently minded, very rude, all things I actually rather like, but she's also an asshole. And Harrow the Ninth, the necromancer princess of Pluto, is also just mean and manipulative and bitter, and they both have very good reasons for this, and they're very compelling characters when you scratch that surface and sort of get to the neuroses and issues that drive them. But if you go in expecting easily accessible main characters, that's where the problem lies. Other than that, they're great. I'd really recommend them. Nona just dropped. I have some complaints about that one specifically, but hey, nothing's perfect.
I'm trying to remember what I read recently that I actually. Oh! I'm not a giant fan of cultivation novels. And despite the fact that I love Beware of Chicken and I talk about it a lot, I don't. I hate that shit. You know that, right?
I did not, because I'm a huge fan of cultivation novels.
I am not. I dislike them intensely because they miss out on the. I know why people like read. It's power fantasy and it's easy to convert into power fantasy, and it has very specific structural things that is enforced by, I don't know, by culture, by social expectations, by trying to avoid the censors, whatever it is, reasons. It is what it is. I understand it. I'm out. But I finally found one that kind of gels with my idea of how I would like the prose to go. The pacing is very similar to Pyramaba. It's called The Last Ship in Suzhou by Lungs. It even has an editor who is listed, Pineapple Hugs, which is really cool. Somebody actually went out and got an editor. It started about 18 months ago, and it definitely dips into the typical structures of cultivation novels, but it does it distinctly from a philosophical point of view, and it takes it from what I think is a more Taoist kind of thing. And I like it. I like it a lot more than I expected. It's on Royal Road. Check it out if you want. I just read it recently, and there's a bunch of like traditionally published novels that I've also read, but I'm not remembering any of them right now, and I don't have the time to like. No, I have the time. I just don't want to.
That's fair. I had anime eating up a lot of my life recently just because Edgerunners was so good.
Oh, dude, yeah, Edgerunners was really good.
I had been talking about it because they had streamed those three episodes on Twitch, and between them streaming those episodes and us actually watch me actually watching the show, we talked about it on here. It was better than the first three episodes made it look, and I already thought the first three episodes were mind-blowing.
I mean, let's remember it's Studio Trigger, so it is really fantastic.
And CDPR. Like, a lot of people like don't realize that CDPR actually like co-wrote the actual plot. They gave them a ton of materials from the game development for like reference for the city.
Dragonus, let's be calm on CDPR's skills at writing. Like, the plot isn't some mystical, magical thing that was really, really shockingly amazing. If you're a consumer of cyberpunk, you'll see the tropes coming a mile away. But here's the thing, it's executed flawlessly.
It is not about like the swerve twist or if you can see the plot coming. It's about the execution of it. Honestly, if you're familiar and you understand where the plot is going, that kind of makes it better because it's that same sort of sense of dramatic irony. You know what's going to happen and you can see all the pieces coming into place, and it just makes it that much stronger. And no, I will not, tone down my like for CDPR. They write good stuff.
It is amazing animation. The music is just chef's kiss. The way they structured the episodes, the way they showed the scenes, they kept the thematic aspects of cyberpunk, the grunginess, the corporate overreach and power, and the inherent unfairness of the world while someone's rebelling against it and, carving out their own peace. All of those things are there. And it is just really, really well done as an anime piece. Let's get back to talk about TWI, though. Let's talk about another piece that was incredibly flawlessly, well, maybe not flawlessly, but really well executed, which is the story of Laken, the German man who would be an emperor.
Yeah, like one of the more fascinating and, as time goes on, divisive characters. I don't know if I would call this flawless, but I also can't think of any flaws, so.
I can, but then again, I'm an asshole. Pirate hates me, and I will be drowned.
I imagine I could come up and dig up really specific flaws, and I'm sure that they're there, and I probably even noticed them when I was taking notes, but didn't write them down because ADHD brain. Once I start reading, I'm too into it to stop and take notes about it. If anything that I'd say about this, its biggest flaw, one, the disconnect between the early and later parts in the volume is a bit jarring. Because you get the first one, and then it's many chapters later till the second half.
Yeah, that's true. But as I said, I'm more forgiving of that because I've evolved to that point about the collection of stories. I do wish it was. I mean, Pirate kind of self-corrected on that. We know they self-corrected on that because they changed how they tell the stories and how they pattern things. they were still in the middle of learning how to like play with the medium and how to pace things. And yes, I know people, Pirates pacing is slow, but here it was one of those things where like they did the same thing with Wistrom, where I think it's partly an aspect of, you know, it was like a bonus chapter and they didn't want to leave Eren and Ryoka behind, and they were worried that people would get too bored and stuff like that.
Well, if there was ever a good time to leave Eren and Ryoka behind, it was at the start of Volume 3. And I realize that that's a statement some people are going to disagree with me about, but let's be honest. Volume 2 had a somewhat relaxed, establishes a new status quo. We know big things are happening, but it's in a vague, distant kind of sense. This was the time to introduce a new major perspective to start out a volume. It just was.
Yeah, when it comes to these four chapters, though, they do tell a very complete story,
Yeah.
or at least the beginning of a complete story. I did enjoy them when I first read them. I think a lot more than most people did. The way Lakin is introduced, when I first read it, I immediately thought Pirate is writing a kingdom building exercise, right? They're writing kingdom building. This is gonna be, you know, all those lit RPG stuff about people building villages and turning them into the, this was Pirate's version of it, right?
Yeah.
It's not quite that. It's certainly not what I thought it was.
So I think that this was Pirate, because everything Pirate does is sort of tackling these isekai genres from a very character-first perspective.
Yes, definitely.
And this is that from a character-first perspective, because Laken comes in and he does not immediately find his way into the kingdom building until I meant to check the word count for all four of these. It's basically a novella, might even be a full novel. At the end of it is when the kingdom building really starts. After we have met the characters, we have gotten to feel the circumstances, we have gotten to understand why he is and why other people are, and from the characters, then grow the kingdom building. As opposed to, you know, like you were saying with a lot of cultivation stuff, because the genre lends itself well to power fantasy, people will put the power fantasy first, and that drives the story. This is the kingdom building second, and the story makes its way to it.
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit of a Trojan horse too. The way Laken is dropped into the world is super interesting. He's bl okay. First off, Laken's blind, which is a whole thing. I always wondered if Pirate ever did any research or spoke to anybody with and vision impairments to discuss how they dealt with the world or something, or if they just, you know, wrote the story. If only because I wonder how authentic it is sometimes.
It has the feeling of like feeling authentic, but at the same time, like just briefly reference a different author, Brandon Sanderson, who has made it a point to aggressively crowdsource from readers he has with a disability to write a character who was in a wheelchair. And that particular short story, I had never realized before the difference between like the author who can get these people to really help him flesh out the tiniest details. And I do feel like this is slightly missing something in that sense. I don't know if that means Pirate didn't talk to anybody. It just makes me feel like it's not as much the driving force here. I think mostly because it's relatively early on that he gets a skill that sort of allows him to function more independently and really just changes up the whole dynamic.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I guess I break down these ch the story into, I mean, it's pretty simple. Laken arrives, meets Doreen, whom he doesn't understand what she looks like, but she's persecuted and okay, maybe not persecuted. People are prejudiced against her and they treat her very badly and she's in a cottage.
I think you just defined persecuted.
Yeah, I guess. So so Laken just and the two of them hang out for a while, and then he's like, I have to protect her. This is really shitty. How can I do it? Oh, hey, I'm gonna be an emperor. Because emperors can protect everybody. And he just, the system acknowledges his will and just bends to it, and he becomes an emperor. Which we will talk about. But then, and then, you know, the events progress. We learn a little bit about how his emperor stuff might work. And he gives Doreen a new class and possibly a new purpose in her existence. We figure out that Doreen is a half troll, and how she came to be where she is. And then a major disaster occurs in River Farm, the village that's attached to Doreen's thing. And then Laken claims the town, or sorry, the village, and saves everybody. And that's where we end the story. So that's the complete story.
Yeah.
The reason I'm doing the recap is because I want people to recognize how Pirates set up the whole arc of this, in that it was always about Laken's development as a protector. He chooses to take his class because he wants to protect somebody, and he chooses to grow his authority because he wants to protect somebody.
God, I don't want to interrupt you because I know that when we start one of these, it will probably take us the whole like rest of our lives to finish the conversation. I did not get the read that he specifically was trying to protect Doreen when he said he wanted to be an emperor. The feeling I got was more like he just kind of wanted to see if he could. He had kind of had that, I think I can do this. I think that this is possible. And I want to do. God, what's the word I'm looking for here? Because it wasn't like, haha, seeing if I can do it trolling. It was like trying to pick a goal that seemed almost literally beyond belief and then say, nah, I'm going to do it anyways.
I don't disagree, but the reason I don't disagree is because two things can be this true at the same time.
True.
There is an aspect of Laken that is deeply, and we talked about this before the episode started, that I find it is core to his personality and his self, which I call I haven't been able to name it or find a word for it, but it's this sense that you have been challenged by the world, and you have met that challenge, exceeded that challenge. And thus, you are not invincible, but you've done all the hard things. You can't, there's nothing you can put to me that's going to be as hard as this. You get that kind of thing with people who are like Olympians and people who are like doctors and lawyers who spend decades learning their work and dealing with like everything, and policemen who've worked for a long time and social workers. These are folks who get to see and do things and meet challenges that most people never will. And if they are good at their job and capable and the best of them, they develop this level of competence and arrogance, for lack of a better term, that gives them this idea that they can do it. They can face it because they have.
Yeah, it's like a confidence bordering on arrogance, but arrogant always has a little bit too much of a negative connotation for me to t when I'm talking about Laken, at least at this point.
That's fair. That's fair.
There's a great amount of pride, and like we get a little bit about who he is, and I get the feeling, he was probably a bit of a better off person, but he has definitely not had an easy life being, growing up blind. That's definitely a challenge. But I think that he almost feels to me like Ryoka, but adjusted. A better adjusted, a more confident, like, Ryoka, with all of that same sort of confidence, but without the intensely painful self-doubt and like self-hatred and just all of the Ryoka problems that Ryoka has. They almost feel like a foil in that sense.
Yeah, fair. So, just to clarify, when we talk about this, why I think Laken has that sensibility, it's because he is blind. It's because he is also a world traveler. He speaks multiple languages. He's been to different places. He comes from a relatively wealthy background, so he's a bit sheltered in that sense. But he's not somebody who hasn't lived an existence that is challenging. And he's somebody who's confidently met that challenge and had to deal with it. One of my favorite characters in the world from the Vorkosigan series, Miles, is someone who is like exactly like this. Laken reminds me of that. Miles was somebody who was literally in braces, like in a spinal thing from the moment he was born, and he had to find a way to deal with the shit of his existence. And to convince people that he's he's not lesser, and to just make them forget all of the impediments that he had, and that developed a level of like impossible levels of confidence and ability. I mean, it is what it is, but that's there, and I think Lakin reflects that.
A word just popped into my brain during that I feel is close, but also sometimes carries too much negative connotation.
What?
Self-righteous. I specifically think about how he dealt with Prost and Prost's wife, whose name is escaping me right now, and the people coming to harass Doreen, and just the absolute no compromise, polite but absolutely willing to throw down verbally and probably throw hands if he could see them clearly. Just self-righteousness of his, no, you're treating her badly and you're going to stop and I'm happy here. Fuck off.
Yeah, I would think it's something like that. Anyway, I'm not quite sure if self-righteous fits in the context of what I'm trying to describe, but it definitely fits him when he's acting like that.
So I guess I think that I can't separate, I guess, that and what you're trying to describe. It all feels not the same thing, but like I'm looking at different facets of the same gem.
Right. So we've delved a lot into Lakin's, like, personality a little bit. I mean, he has his foibles. He speaks German. He is German. He's, like, I don't know if there was a huge amount of personality, and yet there was in the four chapters that we saw him. We got a definite sense of who he is. Like, irreverent. He knows weird facts, like the Emperor of San Francisco, which is really a real thing, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. He's very serene, but there's a framing device to consider here. We're reading this, and this is very explicitly being presented as him writing a journal, which always makes me feel like there's a certain amount of panicness, freak-outedness, just, you know, whether people mean to be or not, especially because it almost feels like he knows he's writing this for posterity. Edited might be the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that's all the notes I really had for... Oh! In the middle of one of the chapters when he's first introduced, there was a thing that I forgot about. So, a lot of the canes that the folks who are visually impaired use to, like, move around or to create, like, space and stuff, they're usually made out of fiberglass, aren't they?
It can vary. The only blind person that I have known personally was really insistent on having a, like, solid wood one.
Okay, I guess that's good, that's fine. I'm, the ones that I know of, maybe because he's rich or something, he has his own shit, but the ones I know of that were used are usually made out of fiberglass. The reason I mention this is because the material is not something easily producible, and definitely not something in-world, and I wonder if Pirate completely forgot about it, because if he has a fiberglass cane, he could give it to somebody and have them try to replicate that material, because that is not, like, the techniques used in creating fiberglass are really, really complicated, and imagine having that as an advantage for your newly budding kingdom.
I think, like, to try and reverse engineer fiberglass, I think would be just a bit too beyond. But yeah, you're right. It was collapsible, so it probably was made of some sort of light material. Fiberglass seems common.
Yeah, and even if they don't get the part where they use it out of fiberglass, just the collapsible nature of it, the plastic hand, like, there's a lot of little pieces that go into the cane. Anyway, they have cell phones. I'm just saying, Pirate forgot about it, and I want to you remember we talked about finding flaws? Here's a flaw!
No, you're right. It does seem odd that it gets mentioned and dropped, but once it wasn't, like, narratively specifically useful because he got his skill, then I guess Pirate just sort of shuffled it off to the side. You know, it probably got buried in snow.
Yeah, but let's assume that. I guess we should also talk about the aspect where he actually does talk about people in his life from his past. A Zoe and a Teresa, who never gets mentioned again. After the first mention, he says, I need my family again. I remember that line distinctly, partly because I wrote it down in my notes, that he mentions that it's part of his needs. Like, I don't think anybody else, does anybody else say it like that explicitly, remember and specifically point out stuff because Aaron sort of does before this.
Yes and no. Like, you get people who will, like, mention, like, Ryoka talks about her dad a lot. Aaron's mentioned her parents vaguely. Yeah, this is sort of the first time that we've seen a person specifically name names.
Yeah, like, I think, I wonder if that indicates that Lakin's relationship with whatever is brought them to in-world is a little bit different. I don't know. Maybe his class helps him or something. I don't know.
Well, he also, like, that's a whole discussion, but I also not sure how to dig into it without getting into stuff that's too spoilery.
Yeah, let's not.
It also, I think it's telling that they don't really get brought up or thought about much as time goes on, which is a trend really across all the people from Earth.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment.
There are a couple other interesting characters. I think the next person really to start from is effectively the deuteragonist of this, Doreen.
Yeah, let's talk about Doreen and the strange naivete. I don't know. Like, she's underdeveloped, childlike in a lot of ways, and yet somehow not.
She's very sheltered, and it's almost more like she's isolated. I don't think that, I wouldn't call her childlike. I would call her.
In the prose, the way she's presented, yeah, like, it's very childlike.
I get the feeling she did not get language lessons. In fact, I really get the feeling that, like, in terms of pure education, the village has not taught her much of anything. Like, she's probably just had to make do with what she picked up when they took care of her when she was younger and what conversation she can manage, most of which is people, shit kids coming and throwing stuff at her, which is, not a great way to build anyone's self-confidence or social skills.
Yeah, I guess because she's sort of broken down over time and she has so much guilt, literally about her birth. And then we have this whole, I guess the other aspect of it is her finding someone who for the first time doesn't see her, literally doesn't see her, but also in a metaphorical sense doesn't see her as bad.
Well, it's not just like, yeah. See, the interesting thing about Lakin is if Lakin could see her, I don't think he would respond to her terribly differently. But it's the fact that he can't see her that helps her respond to him. That she can sort of approach and talk to him and feel confident with this knowledge that he can't see she's a monster. So she can talk to him like she's a person. When the reality is, I think Lakin would see her as a person either way.
I agree with that. To Pirate's credit and to Lakin's credit, he does seem like the kind of person who would not judge.
And it also, I have always thought of this, the character that immediately comes to mind is Old Blue Eyes, the thing who traditionally his love interest is a blind woman who's an artist. I think she's a sculptor.
She's a sculptor, yeah.
And this is an interesting, fun little reversal of that, where, she's the person who has this monstrous appearance, and he's the blind one.
How did I miss the Beauty and the Beast reference?
Yeah, but there's also, I think, a really interesting dynamic with them, because in a lot of ways, Lakin is deeply vulnerable, isolated, in the middle of a terrifying situation to happen to anyone. And his only lifeline is her. And she is also, in a lot of ways, becoming emotionally dependent on him because he is this person who she has been vulnerable with and let into her life. And they're both incredibly vulnerable with each other. And I think that's important because their relationship, if not balanced properly, could really come across as what's the word I'm looking for here? Squicky.
Squicky. Okay, yeah.
Manipulative. Like, I can understand why villagers might be worried about Lakin being up there alone, a blind guy isolated like that. And I could also understand why people might, worry that Lakin would be trying to take advantage of her. But from what we.
Yeah, I guess I was, when I first read it, my first reaction was, look at this player going after this girl who doesn't know. Like, what the fuck is wrong? What the fuck? What the fuck is going on here on this day? Like, it's not fair, and maybe I'm culturally, like, sensitized to that level of stuff, and again, to Pirate's credit, Laken does not come off as a creep, but it is the thought was there, you know.
Well, I mean, it's not like they just jump into bed. They spent time getting to know each other. And also, I mean, for all we know, Laken is absolutely a player, but there's not a manipulative bone in his narration here.
Yeah, at least with Doreen. I do want to talk briefly about Doreen gaining the Paladin class because it's really interesting to think about the fact that, one, he can give people classes, which implies that emperors can give people classes. Two, paladins are come in multiple varieties, and most people don't know about paladins outside of the D&D paladin, the traditional one, representing God and morals and ideals and all that stuff. Paladins served a function in the court of emperors and of kings, right?
Yeah, well, specifically, it was the Holy Roman Empire
Mm-hmm.
at a narrow-ish time period, and then the term has just stuck and gained a whole bunch of meaning since then. But I love that scene, actually, just in general, because it speaks to sort of their dynamic where Doreen, with her terrible self-confidence and these people that treat her so poorly, hears that there's been a disaster in the village, and she runs to help these people who hate her, and to, dig people out and save lives, lift a beam in this case. And she doesn't hesitate, and she gets back, and you can see, and Laken can hear her crying about how she feels like she's not good for anything. So he says, "Here, you know what? You are an incredibly special person to me. You're a good person. I'm going to declare you my personal champion and paladin." And when she gets that class, I don't know, it was a very touching moment to me. It's very much like he's got this person who he's rapidly, actively falling in love with, and is just seeing how badly hurt she is and just trying to find something he can do to help her. And it fits so well.
Yeah, and the fact that he can see every part of where the land he's claimed, see in a not actually have vision of it, but be able to tell where everyone is and sense them and sort of gain information about it. It's both creepy and very cool and very unique. I mean, there are plenty of blind from comic books blind characters who can see in a different way, echolocation, and then we have the what was his name? Not Deadpool, but the guy with the red skull.
Daredevil?
Daredevil, yes. Daredevil has his own way of seeing. Like, there are ways to do things, but this was interesting. I liked it. I thought the aura abilities and the way he claimed the land was very cool and the way it was structured. I did want to mention two things, actually. One, Prost. Prost becomes a pretty big deal. This isn't a huge spoiler. Prost becomes a big deal. And he's another example of pirate following the trend of introducing a character as very human, not necessarily in the best of positions, sort of limited in how their life goes, and doing the best they can and sort of muddling away. And then they interact with a person from Earth, have their views challenged, and meet that challenge or exceed it and find their own particular way of growing as a person. And oftentimes that comes with massive disasters and deaths. In this case, it was the de near death of his almost whole family. And you see a lot in Prost's development. And it starts here with him helping the village survive this massive snow pileup. Did we mention the part where he meets the Fae, actually?
Well, I was going to get to that, but let me chime in on Prost first, because I so something that's what I think that like sticks out in that theme is that a lot of people in their day-to-day lives, even if they're not the best version of themselves, or you're seeing them in a bad light through the lens of a couple narrow bad interactions. At least in the Wandering Inn, it seems like a clear thesis here is that people have, I don't like the phrase moral character, but a stronger, moral character and can grow to the challenge and be better people if given the chance more often than not. And that in this extreme adversity, Prost is I always want to say forged into a better person. The fires got hot and he came out the other end stronger and not brittle. I like that because it's hopeful and does not exactly match my own personal views on humanity.
I'm giggling because I reread a little bit of the interaction with the Fae. Again, Pirate refolds the Fae. Like, notice that Pirate has introduced the Fae to all of the more like important Earth-based characters. Ryoka, Eren, and now almost immediately, well, not immediately, but within a few weeks.
Almost immediately, narratively speaking, almost immediately after we've met him.
Definitely, narratively speaking, almost immediately. And he makes a deal with the Fae and gives them titles, and in the process, like.
Which was a really creative way to get them on board,
Yeah.
but that entire interaction reeks to me of them wanting him to, like, they showed up and they hung out and they had some fun, and then they, oops, let slip a disaster is coming. And I'm not sure if they were trying to find a way to warn him, or if they really did just want, like, to find to see if what the Emperor could give them. Probably both.
I would say both, because one of the things the Fae are very noted for doing, when it, especially when it comes to rulers of things, is that they will like hint at gifts and knowledge to gain favor with rulers, and rulers tend to have stuff, pretty things to give them, and when they get those pretty things, they give a little bit of information. It's almost one of the more common tropes associated with the Fae. Not just tropes, it's like one of the few sayings rulers can deal with and meet with the Fae. That's the whole thing, right?
Yeah. It is a classical sort of trope and aspect of the mythology, but at the same time, I find myself wondering what their motives are. And maybe I'm a fool for trying to ascribe motivation to the Fae, but I don't know. I always get the feeling when creatures like that are on screen that they're playing a game. And I don't mean like a ha-ha fun game, although it can be. I mean like, I don't think they ever do anything without a purpose. And I thought that was really apparent in a lot of their dealings with Ryoka. I don't think they were just accidentally there near Ryoka in this time of strife to make that deal and save her and Mercia, right? I never assume anything is a coincidence with those tiny little pests.
I'm going to choose to believe it's a coincidence because serendipity is important to me, and if even the Fae are unaffected by the winds of fate and chance, then fuck the world, because then I have no chance to change my fate. Anyway, moving on from the Fae itself, what the hell made Pirate choose that blue bird
The Frostwing.
and give him the beast? I don't.
I think, among other things and other reasons, it is kind of an important character beat the way that Doreen and Laken come together to take care of Frostwing.
Fine.
It's a great opportunity to emphasize that both of them, whatever else is there, have its sort of inherent desire to help for and care for other things. It's a bonding moment for them as part of the way that the story goes. And also, I mean, it's adorable.
Okay, moving on. I guess that's it for my notes on Laken's chapter. I enjoyed it. I liked it. There isn't a lot of prose-based high notes or anything like that, but it was just so well executed. And despite the flaws that I mentioned, it was great.
I personally would say that the final chapter is a high note for me just because the prose and Lakin's. It's the only time in sort of this journal telling that there is a feeling of he's actually worried and panicking. And actually, now that I think about it, this chapter doesn't have a day thing in front of it. So it might be that this chapter is a more like direct look into his brain, but him just being like, I'm not a cop, not a police officer, a doctor, emergency worker, I have no clue what to do here. He's panicked, it's cold, there's so much going on. And you could really feel the people in the village and their desperation trying to dig their like I that chapter, like everything else had felt very leisurely and journaly, and then boom, that chapter just got me.
I would agree that that last sequence was really well done. Like it felt like your heart was pumping through the whole thing. Yeah, that but yeah, outside of that, I can't think of anything else specific to mention. In the context of Volume 3, it's definitely a side story, right?
It's a complete novella, and this almost feels like, because Volume 3 is itself kind of a leisurely volume as we go through, we'll see. And I felt like this was just an opportunity for Pirate to, look at an opportunity to slot in a character who needs to have this novel of his journey here told, but wasn't going to be really tying in easily.
Okay. I don't have any more comments on this. You ready to wrap up, Dragonus?
Yeah, I think that's good. Oh, I just had one thought. Does King's Bounty create gold, or does it find gold? Or does it just guarantee that gold will make its way to you? So, like, you find out about the gold nearby, and then you're just more likely to have an incredibly rich person die with no heirs in front of you, so you get to claim things.
I'm gonna leave that question unanswered because the answer that I do have involves stuff in Volume 9, and you know what? If you think about it for a few seconds, you'll know what I'm talking about.
I know what you mean, but like not all skills work the same, and this one seemed to be trying to work diegetically. All I'm saying, I'm curious.
I mean, I told you, like that. I'm going with that answer because anything else is kind of ambiguous.
Well, pa pass it to the readers then, or listeners then, if any of you have an opinion on how specifically King's Bounty might work, shoot us a line.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins.
Edited by Discanter.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.